So, today I'm going to continue the discussion of the structure of perturbation theory and what we really compute by path integral methods or functional integral methods using in perturbation theory. So that's there will be some overlap, strong overlap with what you did in QFT1, but it's going to be presented from the point of view of functional integral. So first, let me just discuss a bit more in more detail the structure of perturbation theory at first order that I showed you yesterday. So here are the, so that's for the 5-4 theory, and I'm always discussing it in the Euclidean space-time framework, assuming that you can go back to real-time physics by weak rotation afterwards. Okay, so we have term of perturbation theory can be expressed as a sum of terms that can be associated to Feynman diagram. So a Feynman diagram represents just a sum of contribution obtained by using Vick theorem. Okay? So, and they are drawn by these nice diagrams invented by Richard Feynman. So for the vacuum diagram, we have seen that this is the only diagram that appears at first order in perturbation theory. These are the three diagrams that appear at second order in perturbation theory. And we have seen that this diagram is connected. These two diagrams are connected. And this diagram is not connected. So basically, the amplitude associated to this diagram is just the product of the amplitude associated to this one. Okay. So next, for the two-point function, the two-point function at first order is just the propagator of the free theory. Here are the two diagrams at first order in coupling constant. One is connected. The other one is just the product of the free propagator and the first vacuum diagram. Two-point function continued. Now we have seven different diagrams. And out of those, only three are connected. Four-point function, we have many more diagrams, but they are all disconnected at for the free theory, because that's just the Vick theorem that states that it is can be expressed, the four-point function can be expressed in terms of products of two-point function. Here, again, you have disconnected diagram, and the first non-trivial connected diagram is just this vertex function, this cross. Okay? And so again, this is a connected diagram. So if we now focus on the contribution of the connected diagram, it would be called the connected correlation function. Here are the connected vacuum diagram for the vacuum function. For the two-point function, here are the connected two-point function. So you can define out of the sum of the connected diagram an object that is connected called the connected correlation function. And in fact, out of the connected correlation function, it's easy to recalculate the full correlation function that corresponds to vacuum expectation value of products of time-ordered products of operator. And again, these are connected. And you start to see a structure, which is that for the two-point function, you see the two-point diagrams are, in fact, chains of propagator joining sub-diagrams that have a particular substructure, this one, this one, this one, this one. And they are called irreducible diagrams because if you remove any line of this one, it stays connected, you see. So the blue part of the connected diagram are called the irreducible part. And that's going to play an important role in the discussion. Okay? So four-point function, again, you have one single connected diagram. If you go to the connected four-point function at order two, you have this diagram. You have new diagram obtained by just gluing irreducible part on the propagator, on the line here. And you get those three new diagram where you have a part which is irreducible, you see. This part is irreducible. This part is irreducible. This part is irreducible. This part is irreducible. And as a convention, I'm going to define a single vertex, single point, as an irreducible part. Because since you cannot remove any line, it stays connected whatever you do. OK. So that's just a mathematical convention. OK, and again, if you go to the six-point function, the connected diagram of the six-point function, here there are. So you have many of them because you can label the external points in different way. But out of this connected diagram, here are the irreducible part. And you see that you recognize the irreducible part we got for the two-point and four-point function. And you got a new irreducible part, which is this triangular diagram. OK? And I think I'm done. OK. So, OK, I'm going to discuss that. But basically, out of this, you can define an irreducible function, which is defined as the sum of the contribution of the irreducible diagram. But forget this at the moment. I'm going to discuss that a bit later. And I think I am done. OK, so this is the diagram that appears. In fact, now if you go to the irreducible diagram that may appear in the four-point function, this is the single vertex here. Here is a loop. And you have two new irreducible diagrams that appears at third order in the coupling constant. So you see this. Theory, of course, of perturbation becomes more complicated. But reducing to the study of irreducible diagrams makes the discussion much more simple, because you have less diagram. OK, so I think, oh, and again, if you like, and if you want to go to order four in the coupling constant when you compute the six-point function, here is the triangle diagram we had. And now we have one, two, three new irreducible diagrams that appear in the six-point function. That's it. Okay. And I think I am done. OK. So let's stop the presentation and go back to the Blackboard presentation. Can you stop the video? Thank you. OK, so this was the combinatorics. But remember now that, in fact, we expect that any correlation function phi phi may be written, in fact, as a sum from k equals 0 to infinity, some factor g to the power k, where g is a coupling constant of phi 4. And then you have a sum of diagrams with some topology, and essentially with k internal vertices. Okay, this. And if you have n external phi of zi variable, you have n external vertices in those diagram with a fixed point zi. Okay? And so you have a sum of the diagrams. Let us denote these diagrams G for graph, Feynman diagrams called graph. And then you have, well, some combinatoric factor, C associated to the graph. That's something that calls factor that comes, which is called the symmetry factor. It comes from applying the Vick theorem and stating how many ways you can construct an object that is described by these diagrams out of the Vick theorem. And then, of course, you have, of course, the important part is some integral. It's called the amplitude of the graph. That depends on the position of so external vertices. And this is the amplitudes or the integral associated to the graph for the diagram G. Okay. And so a diagram is a set of propagators. So let me represent, start to be some complicated diagram with internal points and external points. What is this integral? This integral in position space representation align the propagator between two points, let us say y1 is y2 describes the function g naught of y1 minus y2, okay, which is the Fourier transform of 1 over p squared plus m squared. A vertex here, an internal vertex with a point x, means that we integrate over the position of the vertex. The external position of the vertex is fixed, so an external vertex means simply that we are going to be just C. And of course, we have to integrate over the internal position. So EI of G is just the integral over the products of the integral over the position of the internal vertices of, so that's the vertices internal. And you have a product over the lines or the propagators of G of, let's call Y minus Y, where the Y may be some X's or Z's, depending on the position of the vertex. So it's just an integral. Okay. So now, of course, as you have seen, I think in QFT1 course, and it's motivated by physics. In fact, it's better to compute the Feynman diagrams in the momentum representation, in particular because out of this Feynman rules for the correlation function, you can extract the quantity associated to the scattering amplitudes through the LSZ reduction rule, which are, of course, expressed in, as a function of the momenta, the four momenta of the particles. So impulsion or momenta means simply taking the Fourier transform of everything, expressing in terms of Fourier transform. So the rules, we have already seen for the free theory now, is that a propagator, in fact, carries two momenta. Let's write this P1 here and P2 here instead of Y1 and Y2. So we are taking the Fourier transform of G0 with respect to Y1 and Y2, and we get a G0 hat, if you want, of P1 and P2, or K1, that is. Okay, let's go. And this is a Fourier transform of this object. So we get a 2 pi to the power dimension d times delta of p1 plus p2. That's a Fourier transform of the fact that it's Fourier transform. And then you get, of course, 1 over p1 squared plus m squared. Okay? So now, what is the Fourier transform of a vertex? It's just the fact that to a given vertex, you have some incoming momenta, P1, P2, P3, P4, which is the Fourier transform of integral over d dx of delta of x1, delta of x minus x1, delta of x minus x2, delta of x minus x3, delta of x minus x4, if you assume that you have 4 phi at different points. So in fact, the Fourier transform of this is just a 2 pi to the power of g a delta function of P1 plus P2, P3 plus P4. Okay? So you have a conservation. You have momenta that are carried out by the line, by the propagator, and they are conserved. You can exchange momenta at the internal vertices, interaction vertices, but the sum of the momenta has to be conserved. The momenta has to be conserved. So there is a conservation of momenta. Which is, of course, just a consequence of invariance by translation in space-time. When you have a conservation law, it means that you have a symmetry. Okay. And now, of course, basically, now what you have for a given diagram, you have a given diagram with some external legs. Now, these external legs are carrying external momenta, P1, P2, up to Pn. Okay? And the amplitudes, the Fourier transform of the amplitude of this graph, P1, Pn, well, it will carry out a global 2 pi to the power d delta of P1 plus Pn component if the graph is just connected. If it has several connected components, there will be one delta function of conservation law for each connected component because you can move arbitrarily each of the component. And then you have an integral, which is now an integral over dd of some internal momenta, some internal momenta, okay, of some products over the lines, of some of one over some internal momenta squared plus m squared. Okay? And of course, you cannot integrate over all the momenta carried by the internal lines because they are not independent. They are constrained given by the conservation law. For instance, for this diagram, for this simple diagram, here you have a momenta P1, here you have a momenta minus P1, and here you have a momenta K. This satisfies the conservation rules. Now for this diagram, I'm sure you have met, you have a momenta P1 here, a momenta P2, momenta P3, and the momenta P4 equal minus P1 plus P2 plus P3. And if here you have a momenta K, here along this you have a momenta which is K plus P1 plus P2. And you must integrate only over this momentum. So the question is, one important question is just how many independent internal momenta. You see here there is one, here there is one, and for the diagram that I've drawn here, you can check, it's a bit more complicated, that you have three internal momenta. Because you can have a momenta along this line, along this line, along this line, and then that's it. Okay. So, in fact, there is a theorem, which is a very old theorem, because it's a theorem that goes back to the theory of electric circuit and goes back to the birth of topology, which tells you how many independent momenta there are. And in fact, this theorem is due to Leonhard Euler, a famous Swiss German and French and Russian mathematician, but mainly Swiss. he was born in Basel, but he spent a lot of time in, I think he died in St. Petersburg. He was invited by Catherine the Great. Okay, so, and it's called the Euler relation that tells you how to compute this. So this number of independent variable is called number of independent momenta, is called the number of independent loops of the diagram, G. Okay? And in a modern mathematical language, I think it corresponds to what's called the first Betti number or the simplicial complex associated to the graph. Okay, and so this number of loops is given by a simple formula. So let me call this number of, so let me consider a diagram G, a general diagram G with V vertices, and V vertices, I can write this as V external plus V internal vertices. So V is the number of vertices. L is the number of loops, of lines. Okay. And I'm going to call the number of loops B. Of loops. B because I'm French and B means boucle. For you, it should be L, but then it's line. Okay. So number of loops. So B. Oh, okay, B for Betti. Perfect. And, okay, that's probably the reason why. Okay, and then there is a famous formula which says that for a connected diagram, graph G, this number B is, and let me just, I'm sure I will make a mistake. I think it's the number of loop. It's yes, here it is. It's the number of line minus the number of vertices plus one because C is one. The number of component connected component okay, if you have a disconnected graph, replace this one by the number of connected components. Okay, so this is the famous Euler relation. And you can check that, well, for this diagram, you have three lines, three vertices, and one loop. Here you have six lines, six vertices, and one loop. For these diagrams, you have, let me forget about this. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 vertices. So 8, 10. 10 lines, and 3. Okay. Okay. Okay, so that's a very general feature for any diagram. You know, it's not restricted to a 5-4 diagram. See. So that's a very general. So now for a 5-4 diagram, well, we are going to use very simple. We are going to use the fact that one line, has two ends. That's a very pretty trivial relation, but let's say it's a consequence of Euler formula, because a line has no loop. L is one, therefore V has to be two. Okay, and for a 5-4 diagram, an internal vertex has 4 legs, if you want, while an external vertex has 1 leg. Okay. Which means that 2 times the number of legs of a diagram, the 5-4 diagram, is equal to 4 times the number of internal vertices plus the number of external vertices. And the diagrams that appears in the correlation function, this is just what I denoted k plus n. K was the number of internal vertices. Okay? So you play with this and you discover that B is equal to 4k plus n minus k. So that's 2k plus n over 2 minus k minus k minus n plus 1. So this is k minus n over 2 plus 1. Okay, so you see the number of loops is proportional to the number of internal vertices. Each time that you add an internal vertex, you add a loop to the diagram. And now, here comes something more interesting. That's just combinatorics. Remember that, in fact, there were h-bar factors in the factors. Because, in fact, now, to a given internal vertex in the Feynman rules is associated with the factor minus g divided by h-bar. And to each line is associated an h-bar factor, because the action was so standard action divided by h-bar in perturbation theory. Okay, so the combinatorial factor of a diagram is in fact for diagram G, we have a factor which is minus g to the power k, the symmetry factor, this 1 over some order of a symmetry group of a diagram. And then you have a factor h bar to the power the number of line minus the number of internal vertices, that is k. And remember, B is L minus V internal, which is k, plus n, the number of external vertices, plus 1. So a diagram G with B loops contributes by a factor h bar to the power L minus k, which is B plus n minus 1. So this means that this diagram is in fact over the h bar squared. This diagram will be over the h bar to the power 4, if I'm not mistaken. But in fact, most importantly is that, so remember, B is proportional to K for phi 4. So the more vertex, the more coupling constant. But in fact, the perturbating expansion for phi 4 is an expansion in B times, in G times H bar. So perturbation theory is an expansion in H bar, in power of H bar. K plus, okay. This means that it's what's called a semi-classical expansion. You see? If you keep only the B equals zero graphs, namely the tree-level graphs, what you get is a theory at h bar equals zero, and you get a classical theory, classical physics. B equals one, which is called one loop diagram. Means you are computing the leading quantum correction to classical physics, etc. So it's a very important feature to remember. Yes?
Could you repeat why the expansion that we started in the coupling is
yes.
the expansion in H bar?
That's because when I start from an action, which is S of phi, when I start from a functional integral, which is exponential of minus 1 over h bar times some classical action plus g times some interacting action. This is the free field action. This is the phi 4 action. And I expand in g. You see, I could say I am expanding into g over h bar. Namely, there is a g over h bar. But there is a h bar per propagator. So in fact, it's an expansion in sum over k of g k, h bar to the ak. There is some h, some global h bar with some. All right. So each time there is a g, there is an h bar. See? So this was for this particular action. But as I'm going to show soon, if you take from a general action, or replace this action, which was basically S0 plus G phi 4, imagine that you have a more complicated action, okay, or more field, you know, gauge field, fermionic field, etc. Then in general, you get an exponential of minus 1 over H bar, S of phi with a S of phi a more complicated action. So then, in fact, you have different coupling constant, and you have to think about what are the term in a the terms in a perturbative expansion in various couplings that are of the same order of magnitude. In fact, in order to count which term in perturbative expansion are of the same order, you are consider its expansion in h bar, namely you have to count the number of loops of the diagrams. And it's not always the number of coupling. For instance, you see, we're going to see example. I think we're going to see examples where you have, for instance, gauge series plus X field. Yes.
Where in our derivation of the path integrals?
Is there?
Sorry, in the expectation values and all those things. Where
yes.
did we use that our variables were Gaussian?
Ah.
Where did we use that the field phi was a Gaussian variable?
Oh, we use it in the Gaussian variables because we expanded around the free field action.
Right. So especially specifically to calculate the amplitude, we also the cumulant and all that, we use that it was Gaussian, right?
Now we make a perturbation theory starting from the free theory, which is Gaussian. So in the whole functional integral, phi is not at all a Gaussian.
Yeah.
Independent variables. It's only in perturbation theory that you can treat each term of perturbation theory is some complicated expectation value calculated for a Gaussian field.
Okay, but if you had a field which was not like for which the action was not quadratic,
yes,
then you would not retrieve the same results.
No, because we cannot use a Vick theorem. So it may mathematically it makes sense, but it's more complicated to compute it. There are cases where one is able to do perturbation theory around a non-Gaussian theory, but that's mainly when you have a non-perturbative tools to study the theory. So, for instance, you are going to meet, or you already heard about conformal field theory. There are some special theory, in two dimension or in four dimension, that have a special symmetry. They are called conformal field theory. And in this case, there are tools that allow us to do perturbative expansion around the theory, starting from a theory which is non-Gaussian. But these perturbation theory do not involve Feynman diagrams.
Okay.
They involve other objects. Okay. Okay. So. Okay, so you see, I started to discuss a bit what are those amplitudes, those integrals, but I'm not discussing the fact whether they are finite or infinite at short distance. Yes?
If the number of loop is same, but the number of vertex is different, but can I say that it is same order? If the number of vertex is different,
yes,
but
7.
The number of loop is the same, can I say it is same order?
Yes.
Like, even though, if the number of vertex is different, the coupling constant is multiplied by different numbers.
No, this is a very general result, you see. You see, this is a general, and this is the result for phi 4. This is for phi 4. Okay, theory. So, once you have that, everything is fixed. You know k, you know the number of external legs, you know b. You have no choice. You cannot find a graph where you are free to choose B and K independently of this relation. Yes?
But two different diagrams with different numbers of vertices,
yes,
they are different orders in G, right?
Yes.
But you say that the order in H bar is determined by the number of loops.
Yes. But
rather than the number of vertices.
No, but through this relation, the power of h bar is proportional to the number of loops, but it's also proportional to the number of k, of vertices, because there is a topological constraint. If you add a vertex,
yeah,
you add a loop. Okay? You see? And that's obvious. You start from, you start from this diagram which has no loop, and you add a vertex, you add a loop. You start from this vertex. You see? And you had a loop, you had a vertex, you had a loop. You add two vertices, you have added two loops. It's a topological constraint. You cannot play with that.
And that B equals 0 means that H bar doesn't contribute?
Is yes, exactly.
Is that at the level of endpoint functions or
yes,
scattering up?
Well, at level of endpoint function, yes. Well, you have an h bar, a global h bar. I'm going to explain that. It comes from what you have computed. But basically, if you have a three-level compute a complicated function like that. Okay. Using the rules, the Feynman diagrammatic rules. Okay. So you have momenta, you compute, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an object it's a quantity that looks quantum, which is quantum because, but there is no H bar correction. So it means that in fact that it's something that you can compute in perturbations in classical physics.
But it is going to have a power of H bar to the n minus one.
Yes. Yes.
But in classical physics, there's no H bar. So
no, but for instance, you see, this object will correspond to a diffusion amplitudes, if you want, diffusion scattering amplitudes, you know, some kind of scattering amplitudes of a system where you create a part, you create a bunch of particles here. They interact, they propagate, and then you annihilate them later on. So you may have, for instance, here a system where you have created three particles, they interact, and at the end you end up with five particles and you measure the correlation with the five particles, outgoing. So you have a process where you have five particles entering. Okay? Five particles. So it's a quantum process because creating particles is a quantum process. You have to excite, do something to the vacuum to create particles. Hence, there is one H-bar of particles you create or annihilate because creation and annihilation operators are quantum objects. Okay? But if this is a tree diagrams, once you have done that, what's happening inside is in fact classical. So you could, if you were able to write what is a classical field that you have once you have created your particles, you let your classical field evolve according to the classical equation of motion of the field, and then you annihilate. So it doesn't mean, of course, you are right, it doesn't mean that this is a completely classical process because creation process and annihilation is quantum, but it means simply that the evolution of the wave function between the creation and the annihilation obeys the classical equation of motion. Okay. But we are in a second quantized theory. So, you know, the classical equation of motion of a second quantized theory is some kind of Schrödinger equation for the wave function because it's a wave function which is a field. So, view from the point of view of first quantization, it's a quantum process because you are computing the evolution of some wave function. But view from the point of view of second quantization, it's a classical process because you are computing or interested into the evolution of a classical field, of a field that it can be treated by classical mechanics. So in this sense, it's classical. But that's
In these Feynman rules, do we also get propagators for the external lines?
Yes, 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 of course. That's what I stated here. You have a product over all the lines.
Yeah,
because I'm considering connected functions. So I'm not considering scattering amplitudes using the reduction rule. I'm considering just correlation functions. So there are propagators for all the lines. Okay. That's because we are considering correlation functions. Not scattering amplitudes. Okay. Okay. So once we have done that, I'm going to show you how you can treat in a very global way those correlation functions. So I'm going to introduce the concept of generating functions, or rather functionals, or the correlation functions. Because they allow us to see what's going on and treat all the correlation function in a very global way. So it's a mathematical tool, but it's important. So generating function. In fact, I already introduced generating function for the free field. So now I'm just considering a general theory, like phi to the 4, which is defined by some functional integral. I'm considering the Euclidean in an Euclidean setting, but that works as well in the for functional integral at real time. And simply, as I did for the free field, I am introducing a source term, which is classical. And I make this big functional integral a functional of a classical source term. So G is a classical, G is just a G of X, data of G of X for X in space-time, let's say RD. It's a classical field, which is called the source. So you treat it not as a random variable, just as a parameter of the theory. But phi is, of course, phi of x is our random variable. We integrate over. Okay? And g phi means simply, in a shorthand notation, integral d dx g of x phi of x. Okay? Okay, so this is defined at a completely formal level. But if you can make sense of this, as for the free theory, you see that when you compute the expectation value, for instance, you compute ordinary correlation functions, that will allow us to compute expectation value of products of time order, products of operator vacuum elements in the classical theory. This correlation function, let's say phi of z1, phi of zn, are just obtained by taking functional derivative of this functional with respect to g. Because each time we take a functional derivative with respect to g at a given point x, we get a 1 over h bar phi of x. So we can write this as h bar to the power n, functional derivative with respect to the value of g at point x1 up to functional derivative with respect to g at point xn of this function z of g, this functional g of g. We normalize it by the functional integral without g term in order to get probabilities, so that expectation value of 1 is 1. So we divide this by z of 0. Okay? And at the end, we set g equals 0. So this function z of g is said to be the generating functional of correlation functions. Okay, so I've just redefined an object, but simply manipulating z. If we are able to do calculation directly on z, we are manipulating all the correlation functions at the same time. We don't have to do calculation for the two-point function, four-point function, and n-point function separately. We are manipulating all of them. Okay. So this is the definition of z of g. So in some sense, this is just so you can, this contains all the correlation functions. So now, you can, in fact, rewrite this as formally, you can write Z of G. No, I'm going just now. That's okay. I think that's okay. So now you may ask, is there something for the connected correlation function? So I can define the connected correlation function phi of x1 up to phi of xn. But connected by just taking the sum here, but restricting it, sum from k equals 0 to infinity in perturbation theory, g to the power k, sum over all the graphs, diagrams with k vertices, and n external legs, but connected. Okay, and the symmetry factor times the amplitudes of the corresponding graph. So I restrict the sum to connected diagram. I define this as connected function. So is there a generating function for this object? Of course. So you can define formally, I'm going to define W of G simply as formally as something which will be summed from n, summed from n equals 0 to infinity, 1 over factorial n, integral dz1 dzn, g of z1, g of zn, times the connected function. The connected function. So I regroup in a formal series all the connected endpoint function into an object that I am calling W of G. Is that clear? So it's a formal power series in G, and each term is a formal power series in G. In Gi, and each is a formal power series in the coupling constant. So it's a double formal power series, exactly as this one is a formal, if you expand in term of G, it's a formal power series in G, and each term of the formal power series in G is a correlation function, which is a formal power series in the coupling constant. Okay? Okay, so this is a graph theoretical definition of the generating function of connected. So this is a generating functions of connected correlations. Functions. Okay? And now, what is the relation between this and this? Is there a simple relation? In fact, it turns out that there is a very simple relation, so let's call it a theorem. W of G is just h bar times the logarithm of Z of G. So if you consider that this is a formal power series, so you can define its logarithm by taking the first term, then the second term, then the third terms. Then you have this relation. And well, I added an h bar here because that's what's usually done, and that's quite convenient because, in fact, what? Remember, here you have an h bar to the power n, but thanks to this, it will turn out to be the correct powers of B. So what does this mean? I'm going to show you, well, not a complete proof, because it will be a bit long, but assume that W of G is defined in this way. Assume it's the sum of the connected function. So what is it? First, you have the term of order n equals 0, which means a vacuum diagram, connected vacuum diagram. OK, so connected vacuum diagrams, I'm going to write one here that I'm not going to explain. And then there is this diagram plus this diagram, remember? OK. Basically, it is this kind of object. You see. And this is just a constant that I'm going to explain later. OK. So this is this term of order 0. Then you get a term of order g times. So now you have the term of order g, so the two-point function. And the two-point function, we have seen that it is the propagator. So let me write it this. Plus this object, plus this object, this object, plus this object, this diagram, plus this diagram. Okay, where this object means just a G of a G. Inserting a G. Then you have the diagrams at order 4. And the first connected diagram is this diagram. And then you have this diagram plus this diagram. This is the term of order plus. Etc. Okay. So, computing what is inverting this relation means that W of G is exponential of 1 over h bar W of G. Namely, this is 1. Plus W plus 1/2 of W squared plus 1/6 of W6 plus etc. If I don't find the edge bar. I just expand, yeah?
One W should be a Z.
Three, yes.
A Z. I said you have W equals exponential of W.
I'm sorry. No, that is Z, yeah. I'm very sorry. Yes, of course. Okay. So you just expand the exponential. So if I write this, what I get? I get that Z of G. This is first 1. So 1, I'm going to represent it by just nothing. 1. Then I get the sum of this diagram. So connected diagrams with 0 loop plus the connected diagram with 2 external legs plus the connected diagram with 4 external legs. Etc. So this is okay. This represents the sum of this diagram. This term represents those terms of this diagram. This represents the sum of these diagrams, and the C means connected. Okay. Then you have these terms, which is 1/2 of the products of two connected diagrams. So what do you get? You get if you expand the product, you can have CC plus C this plus C times this diagram. Okay, plus diagram, which are this one, plus etc. So these terms, in fact, represent the sum of all disconnected diagrams with two components. So this is the sum of two connected components. And then, of course, you continue, and you are going that the third term will be given by the sum of diagrams with three components, et cetera, et cetera. So this is just how the combinatorics works. Of course, in order to prove that carefully, you have to prove that the factor here of the exponential, and each diagram contains some combinatoric factor. So you have to check that the combinatorics of the symmetry factor works out. So that's the part that requires some work. But it works. So the combinatorics symmetry factor okay. So this relation, in fact, is just a functional way to manipulate combinatorics of diagram. Okay. And if I can make an historical mention, in fact, I mentioned that this concept of using functions to represent combinatorial relation between objects is also an invention of Leonhard Euler. He was a prodigiously inventive mathematician. So he invented for a different kind of problem, which is in fact called the problem of the Catalan number. He invented the method of generating functions, namely functions that you can use to manipulate a whole ensemble of geometrical of combinatorial objects and obtain combinatorial relation just by algebra. So one way to mix geometry and algebra. OK. OK, so now I'm going to discuss the irreducible functions. Because as we have seen, they are simple. And in addition, if you take a connected diagram with some external legs, and if it's not irreducible, but you can show that it is always, can be always decomposed. Here I am giving an example of a 4-point. But this is valid for any. It can be always been written as a tree with irreducible vertices. And this decomposition is unique. Well, it's geometrically trivial. Okay. So this object here, you see, irreducible, are called those irreducible, or rather one particle or one line irreducible set diagrams or given diagrams, and one particle or one line irreducible diagrams are diagrams such that if you have a diagram like that and you take some, it has some internal line, if you cut, it is connected, and if you cut the line, you remove the line, it's still connected. So you cannot reduce it to something simpler by cutting a single line. And we have seen the two examples at one loop of irreducible diagram. This is the irreducible diagram. So you don't have to include the two external legs into the diagram. Otherwise, you could cut it. And this diagram. Okay? Because this diagram, if you cut this line, it remains connected. Okay. So, you may ask, you may consider, is there a generating function? Generating function for the irreducible parts or diagrams. Okay, so you can define formally a generating function for the irreducible part just by giving the sum, yes?
You said you could cut one line in that diagram and it still be connected?
This one?
This one.
Yes, because if you cut this one?
The one to this.
Yes, because if I cut one line, I get this diagram. See, so you see. And this diagram contains those two vertices and this line.
But is it a valid diagram for the same thing?
No, no. It's a diagram in the sense of geometry. It doesn't have to be a diagram of phi to the 4. In fact, it is a diagram of phi to the 4 because it's a diagram that appears in the phi 6 correlation function. But here, this is a definition which is purely geometric. So it's a definition that comes from graph theory. At that level, there is no physics. Okay. If you open a mass book of graph theory, you will see that discussed for very general system. Yes?
When we look at the definition of the of the generating function for general correlation,
yes,
it's like the partition function, right?
Yes.
So we can think about the Green's function as a kind of order parameter of our system.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
So how does it relate to a connected order parameter? What is the difference, physically speaking?
Okay. So if you think about this as a condensed matter or StatMech language, of course, Z is a partition function. Remember that h-bar plays a role of the temperature of the statistical system. So Z is a partition function. W is temperature times the log of Z. So W is minus the free energy. Okay, and the object that I'm going to define now will be that I'm going to call gamma. It's called the Gibbs potential. Okay. Yes?
When we calculate the connected part, like we have to differentiate the W, the
yes,
connected generating,
yes,
function. But maybe I'm confused, but if I differentiate it, like log of Z,
yes,
make 1 over Z times differentiation of Z, right?
Yes.
But how's it different from the one for the generating function, like it still have a set of zero in the denominator?
No, you don't have it, because in this case, yeah, I should have from this definition, I'm not subtracting anything. From this definition, the connected correlation function, connected, is just a functional derivative of W of G, G equals zero. So this is a difference with what's going on here. And the difference is that if you take Z of G and do not divide by Z of zero, you see, you get the vacuum diagrams. And in the correlation function, you want to have disconnected diagram, but you don't want to have disconnected diagram with vacuum part. So if you consider just this, you get all the connected diagram, and you have to divide by Z of 0 to get rid of the vacuum diagram. This makes what you need to compute the correct correlation function. You need to normalize things properly, so to divide by the energy, the vacuum energy of the energy of the vacuum of the interacting theory and not of the free theory. Now, if we are considering connected diagram with endpoints, they do not contain vacuum diagrams, so you don't have to divide. Okay? Okay, so let me. Well, at least I'm going to have a. Yes. Okay, you can ask questions, but I'd like to at least get to the definition of this object. So what I'm going to define is this. Now, I'm define a generating function for irreducible part. And okay, so let's define this. So one has to be just a bit careful, because if, for instance, you define an irreducible part of a diagram, it has internal vertices which were connected to some external legs, but we don't want to include the external legs into the irreducible part, because then the diagram would not be irreducible. Okay, so these are, you know, for instance, x's, where x's are internal vertices, position of the diagram, but we don't want to include the external legs. And in particular, we may very well have an irreducible diagram where two internal legs, two external legs reach the same point, for instance, here. Okay. So what I'm going to define the amplitudes. So let me call, let us say, gamma instead of G, an irreducible part. Okay. So I'm going to define what is the amplitudes in real space, so so I'm going to define an irreducible part, and I'm going to associate to the external legs some position x1, x2, xm. Okay? I'm in real space. And I want to define what is the amplitude to find my integral of this irreducible part. Okay? So this is going to be integral over the internal vertices. Of the products over the internal lines of the ordinary propagator, but simply I am adding to this a contribution to the external lines. So the external lines are those lines that are represented by dotted line, and the internal lines are the line of the diagram that are represented here by internal lines. You see? And to this, I don't want to include those lines because they are not part of the diagram. So I just want to enforce that this point is equal to this one. So I introduce a delta of x external minus x internal, where this is some x internal and some x internal. So I define the amplitudes of an irreducible diagram by this formal definition. And that's a bit formal, but let us just apply this to this. For this diagram, this is an irreducible diagram. Here I have a position x1, here I have a position x2, and here I have some position x. What does this mean? The amplitude of this diagram is integral over d of x of g naught of 0 delta of x1 minus x delta of x2 minus x. So this is just delta of x1 minus x2. So these points are to be equal to this one and to be equal to this one times the tadpole diagram g of 0. So that's okay. See? The amplitude for this diagram, which now have x1, x2, x3, x4, and some points x and y, there will be a delta function here, a delta function here, a delta function here, a delta function here, and an ordinary propagator here and here. So this will be, in fact, delta of x1 minus x2, delta of x3 minus x4, because those two points are the same, times g naught of x1 minus x3 squared. You see? Take this as a definition. And if you consider a connected diagram which is more complicated than this one, this is a three-loop diagram, but here you have only three points, x1, x2, x3, x4, then you have no delta constraint, so you just have g naught of x1 minus x2, this propagator, this one, g naught of x1 minus x3, this propagator, etc., up to, in fact, you have all the possible propagators. Okay, so that's what, how are defined the amplitudes and this definition is easier to understand in terms of momenta. In terms of momenta, or momenta representation, we get exactly the same representation, but simply, no, you have the internal propagator that are just 1 over p squared plus m squared, and you have the external legs that are, so this is internal legs, and the external legs is just the Fourier transform of delta, so it's 1. So these legs are called amputated legs, because in fact, you know, in momentum space, removing the contribution of this line means associated to this line is just 1. It doesn't carry any momenta. Okay, so in momentum representation, this rule is quite simple. But, so for instance, in momentum representation, again, this is just integral d dk over 2 pi d, 1 over k squared plus m squared, because I have this momentum, and these lines carry no momentum. So that's the rule that you have met in QFT1, I think. Okay. So that's work everywhere, except for the propagator, because what happens if you want to amputate the single propagator according to these rules? You have to remove its left extremities and its right extremity. So you have to amputate it twice. In momentum space, this is quite clear what you are doing. It means that you, one is p, 1 over p squared plus m squared, and you multiply it by p squared plus m squared. So to amputate it twice, namely doing something like this kind of line, you see, means that in fact you associated to this object p squared plus m squared, which is p squared plus m squared squared divided by p squared plus m squared. So if you want to be consistent, this is the rule you have to adopt. Okay? Propagator, twice amputated. Okay. So these are the rules. And once we have that, okay, we can define a generating function gamma as sum from n equals 0 to infinity, 1 over factorial n, integral dz1 dzn. I'm going to introduce some source term, but for some reason, I'm going to call it var phi of z1, var phi of zn. So this is what's going to be the source term for amputated functions. So I'm not using the notation g, but a different notation, and we are going to see why in a few minutes. And then for each mean function, I sum over k from 0 to infinity. I get g to the power k. I get some combinatoric factors. And then I get sum over diagrams, irreducible diagrams, okay, with n amputated legs and k internal vertices, okay, or the amplitudes I gamma of z1, zn, defined by those rules. So this is just a definition in terms of diagrams. Okay? And now, the theorem is, what is the relation between this generating function, z and w? And the theorem is that, in fact, this generating function of the irreducible diagram is what is called the Legendre transform of W of G. The Legendre transform is an object that plays an important role in math and in statistical physics. Yes?
In the diagrams of the lines, how does it change from like a solid line with two dashes and then there's like a dotted line?
Yes.
I'm not sure what meant by that.
You are not sure of the relation between a dotted line?
No, I just, it was like this line and then there's two dashes on the other side and then it equals this other one.
I'm not sure I understood the question. This one?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on.
No, this one?
No, the one on the bottom.
This one?
Yeah.
No, it's just I'm drawing the double amputated propagator, if you want, by just two cuts, because I mean I have amputated it twice. So, in fact, you can represent, I think in the lecture note, I represent such a line by an ordinary line with a cut, which means we amputate this line. And in that case, amputating this single propagator means amputating it at both endpoints, so we amputate it twice. So it's just a notation. Okay. Well, I think I will have to discuss that. Well, when we are going to do explicit calculation, you'll see that next week. Okay. So let's end up with a theorem. I won't have time to explain it in detail, but gamma of phi is just the Legendre transform of W of G. So Legendre transform of a function is a mathematical transformation, which is non-linear, so it's not like a Fourier transform, but it's some object which is very important in minimization problem. So in fact, for instance, the relation between free energy And what is it? Enthalpy or in thermodynamics are given by Legendre transform. Calculating the equilibrium shape of a crystal as a function of its surface tension is called the Wolf problem. You solve that problem using Legendre transform. So Legendre transform appear in any classical problem where you want to minimize something, extremization problem. So in our case, how is it defined? Okay. So this is the Legendre transform of WG. What does it mean? It means that we start from W of G. Okay. We have seen that the one point function is the functional derivative of W of G. Definition. So at that stage, we were interested in computing expectation value in the vacuum, G equals zero. But you may be interested in computing the expectation value of the field in a state of the theory which is not the vacuum, but which is a state that is obtained by performing the functional integral and keeping G different from zero. This means that you excite the system. So if you set G equals not to zero, this will become a functional of G. So this is expectation value of phi in an external source field, classical field. This is a classical field. Phi is a quantum field, classical field. Okay, and then phi depends on G. And it's depend in a non-local way. So phi becomes a functional of G. Okay. So if we do that, we start from this. Okay. So this expectation value of a quantum field coupled to an external classical field is a functional of this functional field, but it's a number. So let us call it var phi. So I'm calling var phi, which is a functional of G, as the expectation value of phi in the presence of G. And therefore, it's defined by this. Okay. So this is a classical field, which is a functional of a classical field given by the expectation value of a quantum field. Okay. So now, let us assume that we can change a variable and treat G as a function of phi. We invert variables. Let us assume that if we know what is the value of phi, we can solve the inverse problem and find what was the source term such that the expectation value of phi would be equal to var phi. Okay, this is, I'm used to text, so phi is obtained by what is called var phi. And phi is phi. Okay. We are so used to thinking tech that we are not yet, I'm not yet using some virtual or mixed reality, but I'm working in tech reality or LaTeX reality, which is, okay, so let's assume that we can invert those two variables. which is true. In fact, it turns out it will be true in perturbation theory. So it's possible. It makes sense for the free theory. It's very easy to see. And if you make a small perturbation, then it's still valid. Okay. So we assume that we can invert those two variables. And consider that it is phi. We have control on phi, not on g. So we are going to interested into a minimization problem. We want to know, we know a theory, we know the expectation value of the field. What is the quantum theory corresponding to? Okay, so then the Legendre transform of G, of W, which is a function of G, is a function of phi, hence this notation. And it's defined simply by G dot phi minus W of G, where G dot phi, I'm using the same notation than here, so it's the integral of a whole space of G of X times phi of X. But now, it is G that is a function of phi, and not phi that is a function of G. Okay? So, if you know how to compute this function, then you automatically get all the irreducible part, all the irreducible vertices of your theory. And that's what we are going to do, well, next week. We won't have time to do this. But let me just end up with a few properties. Two important properties of the Legendre transform. Properties. Okay. First, let me invert this. I can write W of G as G dot phi minus gamma of phi. Okay, I've not done nothing. But now I'm considering that G is a functional of phi. So, this is not really a property, it's just a definition. Now, the important property is that if phi of G is a functional derivative of W of G with respect to G, so phi is functional derivative of W of G with respect to G. So when G phi is considered as a functional of G, this is completely equivalent to state that G considered as a functional of phi is the functional derivative with respect to phi of gamma of phi. So it means that if gamma is a Legendre transform of W, W is the Legendre transform of gamma. Otherwise, Legendre transform times Legendre transform, right? L Legendre transform equal identity. The Legendre transformation is an involution. Okay, so that's a very important property. So that's property one. Property two, which is rather a consequence of that, of the first one. Since G of phi as a function of phi is d gamma of phi divided by d phi, look for the minimum of gamma of phi. The configuration of the field phi where gamma of phi is minimum. is of obviously solution of, so let me call it phi naught. It's a solution of delta gamma divided by phi, phi naught, equals zero. Okay. Which means that g of phi naught equals zero. Now, go back to the first Legendre transform. What is phi when g equals zero? This is just the expectation value of the quantum field in the vacuum of the theory, not in the theory coupled to external field. So if you find the minimum of the effective of this object, you get the properties, you get information on the vacuum of the theory. In particular, you can check for a given theory whether the expectation value of the field is zero or non-zero, which means, for instance, is a symmetry broken or unbroken in a quantum field theory, etc. And finally, I realized that I've not said the most important fact. This object, gamma of phi, is called the effective action of the quantum field theory. So it's a classical quantity, which is denoted, called the effective action of the quantum field theory. And phi, defined this way, is called the background field. So it's a classical field, but it's called the background field because basically phi corresponds to the expectation value of the quantum field. So the quantum fluctuation of the quantum fields are around this classical configuration. So this is a background field viewed by the quantum theory. So we are done. Thank you.